From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. There used to be a ballpark there, but there may soon be a state-of-the-art mixed-use basketball complex in Brooklyn. Ahead on Only a Game, will the New Jersey Nets become dem bums? And if so, who is Spike Lee going to root for? Also, for those who can't wait for Super Bowl Haiku Week, a trailer of sorts, and Foursquare for adults. Also ahead, the Utah Jazz find unexpected mediocrity in the post-Stockton Malone era.
They're not the same as when John Stockton was running the team. Point guards shoot a little more, they look to score a little more, and I think in the long run is better for the team.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Two American soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb that exploded today west of Baghdad. The attack occurred north of Fallujah, 50 miles west of Baghdad, in the so-called Sunni Triangle. U.S. officials say the convoy belonged to a task force All-American. The group includes elements of the 82nd Airborne Division, as well as other units. A vehicle exploded near a U.S. military police station in Samarra, Iraq, today. At least one Iraqi policeman was killed. Samarra is located in the so-called Sunni Triangle as well. The BBC's Mike Woolridge reports from Baghdad.
This latest violence appears to have followed a familiar pattern. The car bomb went off close to the town council building and the main police headquarters in Samarra, damaging other cars and scattering glass over a wide area. A U.S. military police spokesman said an American patrol was turning into the police station to link up with the Iraqi police when a vehicle exploded behind them. The Iraqi police have borne the brunt of much of the violence that's taken place in the country over the months, particularly in this area known as the Sunni Triangle, a stronghold of insurgents loyal to the former regime.
The BBC's Mike Woolridge reporting. A score of nations is banning imports of chicken from Thailand after its government confirmed two cases of avian influenza in humans. From Bangkok, Dwali Saikau Tao reports.
Malaysia, Singapore, and Taiwan have announced a ban on chicken products from Thailand. The disease has been found in six Asian countries. So far, millions of chickens have been slaughtered in the region. Health officials say tests are still being evaluated to confirm the cause of death of two apparent victims in Thailand. In addition, six people have died from the disease in Vietnam. The World Health Organization is warning that people with bird flu be quarantined to avoid any possible transmission to those with regular influenza. It said the combination could mutate and form a deadlier virus to humans. For NPR News, I'm Dwali Saikau Tao in Bangkok.
Vice President Dick Cheney called on democratic nations to work together in the fight against terrorism and the spread of weapons of mass destruction. But the vice president says if diplomacy fails, the United States and other nations must be prepared to use force.
We must confront the ideologies of violence at the source by promoting democracy throughout the greater Middle East and beyond. Second, we must meet these dangers together.
Speaking at the World Economic Forum in eastern Switzerland, Cheney said cooperation among governments and international institutions is even more important today than in the past. Halliburton has pledged to give the Pentagon $6.3 million to pay back the government for alleged overcharges in services delivered in Iraq. Cheney's former company fired two workers it say may have accepted kickbacks for gasoline it delivered in Iraq. This is NPR News. Army and Palestinian sources say Israeli troops killed two Palestinian militants who entered an unauthorized military zone near a security barrier that separates Gaza from Israel. In the meantime, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat warned in an interview with a British newspaper that time is running out for the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Arafat told The Guardian that Israeli settlements combined with the wall Israel is building, which cuts into the West Bank territory, will prevent establishing a viable Palestinian state. Fashion photographer Helmut Newton was killed in a car accident outside a hotel in Hollywood. Police say he crashed his Cadillac into a wall after pulling out of a parking lot and brushing past another photographer arriving at the same hotel on an unrelated assignment. From Los Angeles, NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Legendary photographer Helmut Newton was best known for his stark, erotic, and sometimes sadomasochistic nudes. His stylish black-and-white portraits of supermodels and Hollywood celebrities were spread out on the pages of such fashion magazines as Playboy, Elle, and Vogue. For his provocative photos, he would sometimes pose as subjects in glamorous European settings, wearing nothing but stiletto heels, chains, or dog collars, though he also captured images of artists and politicians. Newton was born in Berlin in 1920 and had to flee with his Jewish family to Singapore to escape the Nazis. Having taken up the camera as a boy, Helmut Newton continued his career to the end, becoming one of the most influential and controversial contemporary photographers. He was 83 years old. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Fewer trees will soon be growing in Brooklyn, and fewer old buildings will be standing there as well if New York developer Bruce Ratner has his way. Mr. Ratner purchased the New Jersey Nets of the National Basketball Association this week for $300 million. He intends to pull a reverse Walter O'Malley and move the Nets into Brooklyn if he can get the necessary cooperation in the construction of a veritable pleasure dome in which the team would perform. Joining me to discuss the ramifications of the deal on the people of Brooklyn, the NBA, the New York Knicks, and various folks who recall that there used to be a ballpark there is New York Post columnist Mike Vaccaro. Mr. Vaccaro, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure.
It's only been a couple of days since the deal went through. Can you give me some sense of what the range of public opinion is in Brooklyn about this?
It's a wide range. I mean, there's a lot of people who are hailing it as the return to Major League Sports. The Dodgers left Brooklyn in 1957, and there's really kind of been a hole in the borough's soul ever since in terms of Major League Sports. And basketball being such a big part of the culture of Brooklyn, it's been a really kind of a celebration among certain precincts. And among others, it's been concern, because there's always going to be concern when you're introducing this kind of a thing into any kind of neighborhood, both the tax concerns, environmental concerns, and obviously there's going to be some people who are going to have to be displaced because there's going to be some parts of the neighborhood that are going to be condemned in certain buildings, in certain blocks. So it's been a wide range of emotions, although I think overall, because most of the people in Brooklyn are going to be personally unaffected by the move, I think people are pretty happy by it.
Jimmy Breslin, among others, has been concerned by what will be lost. He's criticized Mr. Ratner's plan to build a 20,000-seat arena that would be part of a 21-acre complex, including some 5,000 apartments and more than 2 million square feet of office space. Would this development have a negative impact on the neighborhood at the corner of Atlantic and Flatbush Avenues?
I think there'd be a negative impact on certain people, and if one person is affected, you have to feel a certain amount of empathy for that person, because it's just a terrible thing to lose that kind of lottery and kind of be in the way of what the surrounding neighborhood thinks is progress. But I think it's definitely going to be the kind of thing that'll keep us from being an overwhelming and unanimous happy point for the new owners. I mean, the fact is that people are going to have to be told to move, and that's part of the problem of trying to achieve a consensus on this subject.
Apparently, the Nets Brooklyn megaplex would be right on the site that Dodgers owner Walter O'Malley had hoped to build his new stadium on almost half a century ago. Is this kismet, or is that really the only possible parcel on which to build in the whole borough?
I think it's a little bit of both, and the fact is that when you go there and you see the Long Island Railroad yards, I mean, this is obviously something that could, it could look better, put it that way. I mean, mm-hmm. I think this was the thing that Walter O'Malley was trying to sell to the city fathers, half a century ago, was that this is a way to bring this nice new facility and also improve the both the aesthetic quality and the economic quality of the surrounding neighborhood. Part of it is that it really remains kind of an ideal site in the fact that there's 10 subway lines that are within walking distance of the facility. I mean, it comes to the confluence of Atlantic Avenue and Flatbush Avenue, which is about as much the heart of a downtown as any downtown could be. It's easily accessible to people in Manhattan because it's right over the Manhattan Bridge. There's a lot right about picking that site for something such as an arena or, 50 years ago in O'Malley's case, a stadium.
When Mr. O'Malley took the Dodgers west, his argument included his feeling that for racial reasons and economic reasons, the Dodgers couldn't continue to survive. They'd make more money in Los Angeles. What is the thinking about the Nets being a great economic success in Brooklyn?
I do think that the dynamics of Brooklyn have changed. I mean, for one thing, basketball in 2004 is very similar in terms of its meaning and import to people in New York as baseball was in 1956, 57, around there. It's always a tricky situation when you're talking about professional sports, only because, ticket prices for the most part are so high that it really does kind of price out certain people just because it's impossible to take a family of four to a basketball game without, spending a ridiculous amount of money. Now, what the owners of the Nets are talking about is making a certain amount of tickets available for kids and keeping back a certain amount of seats every night that will be affordable for, just for everyday people who want to watch a basketball game. That, whether they do that or not, remains to be seen. A lot of professional sports operations have started out with the best intentions, including the Nets when the previous ownership talked about wanting to move them to Newark, and things have a way not of working out. So that's kind of on the new ownership group now, is making all this stuff happen and making it accessible to the people who are going to be their neighbors now.
From a show business point of view, would having the Nets in Brooklyn instantly create a better rivalry with the Knicks than having the Nets in New Jersey did?
I think that's the one thing that we can all safely say yes to. Of all the questions that linger over this, I think it would definitely instantly bring an on-court rivalry that's been unmatched in New York sports, really, since the Dodgers and Giants used to play each other 22 times a year in the National League. I've been part of this the last couple of years also, trying to almost create a rivalry between the Nets and the Knicks. And part of the reason why that's not possible is because, really, they've never been on a par competitively. But also, it's just harder to try and get people's juices flowing when you're talking about the Lincoln Tunnel. I think when you're talking about the East River, it's a little different. You're talking about Brooklyn and Manhattan that have always been rivals, just the boroughs themselves. And like I said, you're going back to the old Brooklyn-Manhattan rivalry between the Giants and the Dodgers. So, you have all that ancient stuff to deal with also. I think it would really make for a fascinating rivalry, I do.
I assume that at least a fair portion of the people who go to Knicks games go over the Brooklyn Bridge to go to those games. Do they all change allegiance if the Nets are in Brooklyn?
Well, I don't think it'll happen overnight. There are a lot of New Jersey fans who remain Knicks fans, 25 years after the Nets moved into their backyards. Part of the reason I think why the Nets are moving away from that backyard is because they weren't able to convert a lot of New Jersey fans to the Knicks. I think this will be a little bit different. I honestly think that what the Nets will be targeting now are the next generation of basketball fans coming up, the ones who still haven't really declared Nets or Knicks, and those are the ones that are really going to be the target for them. I don't think you're going to see Spike Lee suddenly sitting courtside at Nets games, even though he's a Brooklyn native. I think, longtime sports fans invest a whole lot into certain teams, and once you declare, you declare. But I think for future generations, assuming that this is something we're talking about 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now, you're really going to see something interesting for sure.
Mike Vaccaro joined me on the line from his home office in New Jersey. He's a columnist for the New York Post. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much.
Karl Malone signed with the Los Angeles Lakers in July, thereby severing his 18-year relationship with the Utah Jazz and prompting Jazz fans to mark the day on their calendars when the mailman would return to Salt Lake City as an opponent. That day was to have been today, but alas, Malone remains on the injured list. Still, there's reason for Jazz fans to attend the game, as their team, which many pundits predicted would win 8 games this year, has managed to construct a respectable 21-21 record about halfway through their first year without future Hall of Famers Malone and John Stockton. And as a bonus, Malone's Lakers have lost 10 of their last 15 games. Beverly Amsler reports from Salt Lake City.
Before the Utah Jazz overtime loss to the Cleveland Cavaliers last Saturday night, some friends discussed the team over pizza and soft drinks at a Delta Center picnic table. Betty Randall from Salt Lake City is a season ticket holder who says it's more fun watching the Jazz play this year. She sums up the team's new attitude in one word, scrappy.
They just don't give up. They're just in the fight the whole way, even if they're way behind. And that's my word for them this year.
Randall says she was a little concerned when media reports predicted the team would win only 8 games this season.
Since it's almost a totally new team, I thought, do they know something I don't know? But then I thought, I believe I could win 8 games. So I thought that was really kind of underestimating the team. I'm not a bit surprised that we've done better than that, because they're scrappy.
Phil Miller has spent the last decade covering the Jazz for the Salt Lake Tribune. He says after 18 years, the whole Stockton to Malone concept was getting old, and quite frankly, boring even Jazz fans.
Bringing in all these new players, starting over, no expectations, let's see what these guys can do, has added a lot of excitement to the team. I think that would have been the case no matter how they did. The fact that they've been so successful has really added to the energy surrounding the franchise, especially here in town.
The Jazz went 7-1 in the preseason. Then in their very first home game of the season, they defeated Portland, a team that was expected to do quite well this year. Miller says that sold the team on itself.
They won that game fairly easily. They won it in the second half. I'm not going to say they surprised themselves, but they convinced themselves that they are going to win. The chance was there to lose a lot of games and just write it off as, well, no one expects us to win. And I know their coach fights that all the time. You can't go into it with that kind of attitude, because in this league, a lot of that is self-fulfilling.
One of this year's nagging questions has been, who will replace John Stockton at point guard? The task of filling the sneakers of the NBA all-time assist leader has fallen to Carlos Arroyo, Roel Lopez, and Mo Williams, three men who had virtually no experience coming into the season. Phil Miller.
They're not the same as when John Stockton was running the team. In some ways, the differences are better. The point guards shoot a little more. They look to score a little more. They're not the pass-first presence that Stockton always was, and that I think probably in the long run is better for the team.
13-year-old Jazz fan Graham Bourne of Salt Lake City agrees.
They're spreading the ball around, getting everybody to score. And Carlos Royal, he's scoring a lot of points, unlike John Stockton, who just passed the ball almost all the time.
Russell from Pleasant Grove, Utah, concurs it's been a team effort this year.
What's good about him is they all play together as a team, because if you notice in every game, there's 4 or 5 people on the team that score in the double figures. And then, you know, like in the years prior, it seemed like only 2 or 3 people got, like, all the points. So it's more team-oriented, and each game somebody else comes out and plays. So I'm excited. I really like to watch them this year.
Phil Miller's preseason prediction was an optimistic 32 wins, but says anything is possible at this point.
The past couple of years, barely getting into the playoffs and losing in the first round has been considered failure and a sign of decline. If they get into the playoffs this year and lose in the first round, it will be an unbelievable achievement. The whole atmosphere surrounding the team will have changed. It's already changed. This is a much more popular team now, just as anything new and exciting and seemingly fresh would be.
For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Salt Lake City.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
A foggy day in London town.
Great Britain's Ministry of Defense, which uses the logo Met Office for its weather agency, recently attempted to block the UK registration of the New York Mets logo as the team prepares to sell caps and jerseys there. The ministry maintained that people might not be able to tell the difference between the weather agency and the baseball team.
Oh, that's just silly.
Right. On Tuesday, British officials ruled that the ministry's contention was, in fact, silly. British trademarks registrar George Salthouse offered the opinion that the public would not be likely to believe that the baseball team's goods and services came from the weather agency.
Let's see. Is that Mike Piazza's hat or a foggy day? Silly.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Islanders withstood the Hurricanes of Carolina. The score was 3-2 in favor of New York. The New Jersey Devils blanked the Montreal Canadiens by a score of 2-0. The Washington Capitals fell to the Florida Panthers 4-1. The Dallas Stars shut out the St. Louis Blues 2-0, and the Anaheim Mighty Ducks downed the Minnesota Wild 6-2. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Zeus and the Olympic Truce from Bruce. But first, last week we covered the world of women's college basketball, which means that this week it's the men's turn. So, joining us on the line is Pat Forty, who covers basketball for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to talk to you, Bill.
We have talked before about parity in the college game, and this year it seems the field of teams with a legitimate shot to go to the Final Four is bigger perhaps than ever. Duke is currently number one in the nation. How long does that last?
Well, the way things have been going, it could last a week, it could last 2 weeks, it could last a month, but I wouldn't count on it lasting until March. I think they're really good, but as you said, this is the anything-can-happen season, as we saw just a couple of nights ago. Richmond goes in and beats Kansas in Allen Fieldhouse. Mm-hmm. I mean, how preposterous is that? So if that can happen, anything can happen.
Stanford and St. Joseph's, currently number two and number three, are both undefeated at this point. What is the possibility that either or both goes undefeated into the tournament?
You know, the schedules are fairly beneficial for both of them. I would be surprised if it actually happened, because in this day and age, it just doesn't happen. It hasn't since 1991. When UNLV took a perfect record into the Final Four, in fact, and then lost to Duke. Both teams, I think, are kind of standing out as the best in their leagues, but I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere on some given night on the road they come a cropper.
The Cincinnati Bearcats were undefeated to start the week, but they fell to one of your neighborhood teams, Louisville, on Wednesday. The Cardinals, coached by Rick Pitino, in case you didn't remember that, are number five in the nation. They haven't lost since late November. When will Louisville take its turn as number one?
Well, you know, they're really pushing for it, and here's something you could win a bar bet on, Bill, is Louisville has never been ranked number one, not even for a week.
Isn't that remarkable?
School with two national championships, been to six Final Fours, and is one of the probably the 10 all-time best college basketball programs out there, and they've never been number one for a week. So they're definitely in line there. They're in the rotation, I think, but I don't know when they'll get there.
I love that rotation. Maybe they'd prefer not to be number one, since they've done all right without it.
Yeah, being number one doesn't really get you anything but a big bullseye right now.
Syracuse, the defending national champions, were supposed to falter a bit this year after losing freshman star Carmelo Anthony to the NBA, but the Orange Men, this week's loss to Seton Hall notwithstanding, could very well play in the Final Four, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. They're one of many teams to keep an eye on, and that's, you know, it's interesting. I was just looking up a few things here today, seeing, you know, just where teams were last year at this time, and at the end of January, Syracuse was ranked 24th in the country, and nobody was looking at them and saying, oh, well, they, you know, they're a national championship team. So, you know, there's a bunch of teams out there that right now are probably just positioning themselves to make that big run, and they're one of those teams that could do it again.
The front runner for this year's Fiery Crash and Burn Award, perhaps, is the University of Missouri, picked by some to play for the national championship. The Tigers are not only likely to miss the postseason, but the university's embroiled in one of the uglier scandals in recent memory. How does UMissouri get out of that mess?
That's a great question. That is my alma mater, and it is a mess. As bad as they have been on the court, I think the off-the-court stuff is more embarrassing and more troubling, and maybe the thing that cost Quinn Snyder his job, and maybe several other people their jobs as well. And this is a school that, you know, it's not that long ago was on probation and missed the postseason for NCAA violations in basketball. That was in the early 90s. So to see them back in that situation is really pretty disappointing, I think. It looks to me like this is a team that's kind of unraveling under the weight of the whole situation, and I don't see them doing much of anything.
Pat, do teams and coaches not learn from what happens to them and what happens to other teams and coaches just because the pressure to excel is so high that you do it anyway, even though you know it's wrong and you might get caught?
Yeah, I think so. And you know what? It may be that they learn that they see so many people getting away with it. Maybe that the exception are those people that get caught. I know that's a very cynical view, but you have to wonder. I think that there's obviously strong temptation to cut corners, Quinn Snyder came to Missouri as a kind of a boy wonder, and I think that there were obviously some chances taken and some corners cut in a rush to show that he could become one of the great coaches out there, and now instead it may cost him his job.
Next month, the conferences will wrap up their regular seasons. What should we be paying attention to in this kind of run-up toward the tournament?
Well, you know, I think that one thing, there's a couple of conferences out there that we're used to seeing, you know, right amongst the marquee and getting 5-6 teams in the tournament, and they're having really bad years, and I'll be interested to see what happens to those leagues, the Big Ten and the Pacific Ten specifically. And I think that conferences like Conference USA have a chance to pick up some of those extra bids, or maybe some of the lesser-known conferences, the Missouri Valley, maybe, or the Atlantic 10. So it's going to be interesting to kind of see how these leagues play them, shuffle themselves out, and who rises and who falls. And there will always be teams, you know, that look great right now that will be fading by March, and then others that are coming on. So February is kind of a big positioning month that'll be fun to watch.
Finally, Pat, Indiana State University will retire Larry Bird's number next month. Bird led the Sycamores to the national championship game back in 1979, only to lose that much-heralded contest to Magic Johnson's Michigan State team. The question here is, why did it take Indiana State so doggone long to recognize that this guy's number ought to be retired?
Isn't that funny? It's not like they've been busy with all those other great players there, you know? I mean, it's kind of Larry Bird, and then they've dropped off the face of the earth ever since. So I don't know. I found that to be a little bit curious myself. And if I'm Larry, he may ask that same question when he gets there.
Pat Forte covers college basketball for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and he is our regular college basketball analyst. Pat, thank you again.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
In August, the Olympics will return to Greece, where the Games began nearly 2,800 years ago. To keep Athens 2004 safe from terrorists, the Greek government is spending a record $750 million and will deploy 50,000 soldiers and security personnel. Venues will be guarded for months before the games begin. While Olympic officials are planning for the worst, the International Olympic Committee is promoting the concept of Olympic truce. In ancient times, armies of warring city-states laid down their weapons and stopped fighting during the athletic competition. Now the IOC is trying to re-implement the Olympic truce, Bruce Gellerman reports.
It's one of those golden Greek autumn afternoons as Greek workmen set stones for the sidewalk along the still unpaved roads in the Olympic Village. The village, just outside of Athens, includes 366 new apartment buildings, parks, gyms, and training facilities. In August, it will be home to 16,000 athletes from around the world, and a month later, for a third as many Paralympic competitors. It's an enormously ambitious project, but Olympic Village spokesperson Katerina Barbosa says, despite fears and naysayers, it will be ready on time.
This is one of the houses of the residential zone where the athletes will stay. It's an average house of 100 square meters. And the village in general has 2,292 apartments like this one, more or less, with slightly different aspects.
To prevent terrorists from infiltrating the Olympic Village, there will be heavily armed patrols guarding a high-tech fortress wall enclosing the community. It's an ironic reminder because for 1,200 years during the ancient Olympics, it was a tradition for city-states to tear down parts of their fortress walls after the games. They'd welcome home their victorious athletes, demonstrating they had nothing to fear and could live in peace with their enemies. It's here at Olympia, in the northwest of the Peloponnese Peninsula, that the Olympic Games began in 776 BC. It's an idyllic, sacred spot, filled with oak and olive trees at the confluence of the Alpheios and Kladthios rivers.
Well, let's go down there and find a tree with shade and some stones to sit down.
My guide, Katie Kolias, leads the way to the ancient Olympic Stadium, where, myth has it, Hercules determined the venue by walking as far as he could while holding his breath, a bit over 192 meters or 600 feet. The first competitors ran foot races the length of the stadium while in the nude, wearing helmets, carrying spears and shields. The competitors were soldiers, actually, warrior athletes trained under the watchful eyes of priests.
Over here, you see these plaques? Yeah. And this is where the champions were crowned with the olive branch.
It's right here at the statue of Zeus.
Over here. This is the entrance of the temple, then the cellar. Behind the cellar, another room where only priests were allowed to enter. So you can imagine the people around cheering, throwing flowers at them.
The original Olympic Games were religious festivals honoring Zeus, the father of the gods. His statue here was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world until it was destroyed in an earthquake in 170 AD. According to one myth, the games got their start when a king from Olympia went to the Oracle of Delphi and asked how to put an end to the constant warring between city-states. The answer? Hold athletic competition every 4 years. The kings of Elis, Sparta, and Pisa agreed and signed a truce. Again, tour guide Katie Collius.
The point was the peace. So the priest tried to show the men that instead of killing each other in the battlefields with exactly the same things, could compete in peace in a more noble challenge, their sports. They had to stop the wars and discuss about their problems. So they organized those Pan-Hellenic Games. Before and after those festivities, they announced a truce. They stopped the wars. So besides having the chance to travel in peace, they had the chance to talk about their problems.
Special heralds, or spandephori, bearers of peace, traveled throughout ancient Greece announcing the sacred Olympic truce. Fighting ceased for 7 days before until 7 days after the games, later expanded to 3 months. The truce was sacrosanct and respected as a rule of international law for 1,169 years, even during the Persian War in 480 BC and the most violent conflicts of the ancient world. The sacred truce read, "May the world be delivered from crime and killing and be free from the clash of arms." Violators were heavily fined and prevented from receiving messages at Delphi.
The call for the Olympic truce in many ways tries to remind the world that the Olympic Games have nothing to do with politics. You cannot fight and play at the same time. You know, you cannot at the same time be sending some of your youth in a sports field to compete in peace and some other of your youth in a battlefield to die in war. It just can't happen. It shouldn't.
Greek ambassador at large, Stavros Lambranidis, is director of the International Olympic Truce Center. Founded in 2001 and inspired by the ancient sacred truce, it is now a permanent part of the International Olympic Committee. The goal of the center is for a cessation of hostilities around the world during the 16 days of the Olympic Games.
Sport, perhaps more than any other human activity, can bring people of different colors, religions, ethnicities, political beliefs together to compete, mind you. They don't get together to hug each other and say, "I love you," but to compete in peace. In other words, to channel out aggression from in a peaceful way. And in the process, to get to look at each other in the eye. An opportunity that no other human activity offers you.
In modern times, the Olympics were twice canceled by world wars. There were boycotts of the games in Moscow and L.A., and terrorists murdered athletes at the 1972 Summer Games in Munich. But during the 1994 Winter Games in Norway, there was a one-day truce in war-torn Sarajevo, the venue for the games a decade earlier. In that one day, UNICEF inoculated 10,000 children on all sides of the conflict in Bosnia. And in Sydney 2000, athletes from North and South Korea marched into the Olympic Stadium under one flag. Recently, the UN General Assembly unanimously approved a resolution calling for an Olympic truce, and Ambassador Lambranidis is asking people around the world to go online at olympictruce.org and sign a petition.
Are you asking me, will in 2004, will we have 40 truces? Because that's approximately the number of conflicts we have today in the world. The answer is absolutely no. Of course not. Can we have one or two in 2004? I hope so. I can't guarantee it. I hope so. If we have one or two, is that better than zero? Absolutely. I am not going to allow the perfect to become the enemy of the good here. But you have to start from someplace. This is a marathon run for us in many ways. It is not a 100-yard dash. We know it's going to take a long time, but we're there for the long run.
The motto of the International Olympic Truce Center is, "On your marks, ready, cease fire." In other words, all Ambassador Stavros Lambranidis is saying is give peace a sporting chance. For Only a Game, I'm Bruce Gellerman in Olympia, Greece. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Only a Game. Time now for your letters, which are mostly emails. For a decade, we've been celebrating the Super Bowl with Super Bowl Haiku. Last year, we expanded the fun and held a contest for the best Super Bowl Haiku from a listener. Scott Suma, who hears Only a Game on WNIU in DeKalb, Illinois, won that contest. Remarkably, the triumph failed to stopper his poetic juices. In fact, it seems to have encouraged him. He's begun emailing haikus again. After the two conference championships a week ago, Scott mused as follows. Manning manhandled, multiple interceptions, McNabb Manning'd. Wonderful. But is haiku finally quite the right poetic form for an event the size of the Super Bowl? The bloated spectacle would seem to cry out for a saga or an epic, but there's no time for that. A ballad might work, or how, I wonder, idly, perhaps idiotically, would a sonnet handle the challenge? Thou mayest, I fear, that time of year behold, when many men, or all, or most do cheer the Super Bowl, as they are bought and sold by corporations pushing cars and beer. Some will, I wot, maintain it is mere play, the crashing and collision all great sport, and that the fortunes lost and made that day are innocent, all leisure of a sort. For others, roiling, railing at the cost and at the damage done and time misspent, the game, a tiny boat on oceans tossed, will be as nothing gainst a culture bent. Perhaps the Super Bowls are worst and best, a game, no doubt, but also all the rest. Fans of the sonnet will recognize the above as Elizabethan in form, or mock Elizabethan, or hack Elizabethan, something like that. Fear of prosecution, in addition to the inevitable ridicule, bids me to acknowledge that the first two lines are derivative of Shakespeare's sonnet number 73, I beg his pardon, and lest we all be kept awake by the noise the bard's already making as he spins, rattles, and rages in his grave. We'll be back to haiku next week. Meanwhile, you can reach us by visiting the website, onlyagame.org. Our official email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Letters scribbled or typed will reach us at WBUR 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon. Bill Littlefield has tended NPR's candy store for a long time. But Only a Game isn't the only Saturday source for sweets. You can hear our sports commentator, Ron, Rock Candy Rappaport, nobody actually calls him that, and Nougat, Nuggets of the News, from around the world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR Choose News, that is, News.
I'm Bob Z with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA action, Orlando beat Philadelphia 98-93. Miami torched New Jersey 85-64. New Orleans dumped Denver 97-91. Minnesota edged Detroit 80-79. Dallas stifled Chicago 106-93. San Antonio grounded Phoenix 86-84, and Boston withered Washington 100-89. Elsewhere, Atlanta fell to New York 96-94, Houston bested Indiana 78-74, Memphis manhandled Sacramento 109-95, Milwaukee toppled Toronto 98-86, and the Clippers of Los Angeles detuned the Utah Jazz 93-82. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the Child's Playground game, currently the choice of adult expropriationists everywhere. But first, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
We generally keep the expropriationists away from my child's playground, but that's neither here nor there.
I think that's probably very wise. I woke up today and checked the morning stories on the web, and I was startled and dismayed to find that the Carolina Panthers were victorious in Super Bowl XXXVIII. What's this all about?
Yes, the tiny electronic Panthers beat the tiny electronic Patriots 17-13 in a cyber Super Bowl that was put together by ESPN.com and presumably a bunch of very bored 12-year-olds with stocking caps and time on their hands.
Does this dismay the real Patriots?
No, of course not. It'll just give an indication to the New England Patriots once again that despite being 14-2 and the 7-point favorite in next week's Super Bowl, that the world doesn't respect them, not even the cyber world. No respect even in cyber. But don't you get the feeling that if you just brought in another group of 12-year-old kids with stocking caps and too much time on their hands, that you'd get a different result?
I'm sure of it. Apparently, there is at least one legitimate what-if concerning the real Super Bowl, and that involves whether the game will be played indoors or outdoors, and I assume this doesn't mean they'd move it to the Astrodome if it's too cold.
No, Reliance Stadium has a retractable roof, and the NFL has determined that the roof will adjust to whatever the meteorological condition of the moment is, which means if it starts to rain halfway through the game, they close the roof.
That'll be cool to watch, you know?
You'd watch anything except for the actual football.
That's right.
You know
that. If I can look up rather than down, yeah, it's good. You'll be on your way to Houston shortly. And I'm curious, what do you hope to accomplish among the media horde out there in the Bayou City?
I hope to garner one single quote, one simple declarative sentence, subject, verb, object, that no other reporter has.
Next year,
to fly to the moon by flapping my arms like this.
There you go. Next year's Super Bowl site is Jacksonville, Florida, and they're a bit short of hotel rooms there. The housing solution, more boats.
They're going to dock a bunch of ships on the St. John's River during Super Bowl week. This is great. I mean, I'm glad they didn't do it this year while Master and Commander is still fresh in all our minds because, you know, hey, mateys!
Hey,
duck, incoming!
It probably,
God of the minibars, you swarthy minks.
It probably couldn't get any better than a Tampa Bay-Miami matchup in that Super Bowl next year because it would be rife with pirate humor from start to finish. On Tuesday night, President Bush implored this nation's professional and amateur athletes to, quote, get rid of steroids now. Didn't Jose Canseco play on Bush's Texas Rangers around 92, 93, 94?
We have our share of fun here in our little pop stand with the Avignon presidency, but I have to admit that I heard that and I said, the State of the Union? What? Who? What is about this?
The Milwaukee Brewers are now up for sale, Charlie. How much does a team with 11 straight losing seasons garner on the open market?
Oh, I think it'll command a pretty good price. It has a brand new stadium. It has a very loyal and devoted fan base. It's been criminally misused by the Selig family since 1970. The Selig family, of course, is getting rid of the team because they're about to ride every ride at the Deposition Land Fun Park in the state of Wisconsin. I hope, having spent more than a few misspent hours following the Brewers while I was in college in Milwaukee, that they get the kind of an owner that their fan base deserves.
The New Jersey Nets were sold this week for $300 million. Developer Bruce Ratner will apparently move the team to Brooklyn. If he does that, which team does Spike Lee root for?
Well, if Spike Lee is really devoted for Brooklyn, he'll root for this thing never to go through. And this Ratner fellow wants to build a $2.5 billion complex, at least some of which will involve demolishing people's homes. He's already hitting up the state of New York and some of the local people for taxpayer money. This is just a festival of greed, no matter how many local celebrities he has latched onto the project.
The theory here is It would be wonderful to have a team in Brooklyn, but not where this guy's trying to put it.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, technically, I guess there's no difference between having a team in Brooklyn and having a team in New Jersey, given where they play right now in terms of the Knicks market. But I think, you know, this is a classic example of something just being dropped on people without their advice. And I thought, frankly, we were beyond this in the way we build stadiums and site franchises these days.
The potential move of the Nets has the New Jersey Devils, with whom the Nets have shared exit 16W for over two decades, looking for a new home, possibly Newark. The Newark Devils, you like that?
Yeah, and the hits just keep on coming. They want the state to help them build the arena in downtown Newark to keep the Devils around. Look, there's no defending Meadowlands Arena. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing near it but a racetrack. It's a soulless, ugly cement building. But as I said before, I mean, I thought we were beyond the holding up, especially given the fact that state governments are in worse shape than the federal government is in terms of their economic situation. I thought we were beyond the notion that people would actually have the gall to ask for public money for anything like a ballpark.
The Los Angeles Lakers lost to the Dallas Mavericks on Thursday, marking their 10th loss in 15 games. Should the Mavs feel any better about their playoff chances having beaten these Lakers?
I think the Mavericks can feel good about themselves. The Lakers should start being worried, though. Granted, Kobe Bryant didn't play, Karl Malone didn't play, Shaquille O'Neal didn't play. But sooner or later, the people around them have to beat somebody, and they can't do it right now. And they certainly can't even stay with the iron in the Western Conference. So, I mean, I believe that the Lakers are starting to stumble into a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, where they get so contented at worrying about the people that are injured that they're not too concerned about the people who are actually playing. That having been said, Antoine Jameson of the Dallas Mavericks scored 26 points in 27 minutes, which is something of a hoot.
There will be a change in NASCAR's scoring system. Mr. NASCAR yelps. Anyway, there will be such a change, apparently to create more excitement over the season's last 10 races. So, Mr. NASCAR?
Mr. NASCAR is not a NASCAR purist, as you know. Mr. NASCAR believes that time marches on.
Mr. NASCAR is speaking of himself in the third person.
Mr. NASCAR always speaks of Mr. NASCAR in the third person because Mr. NASCAR and the person, you know, with whom Mr. NASCAR shares space don't get along real well.
I see.
Mr. NASCAR understands that the NASCAR season, oddly enough, has its Super Bowl at the beginning, which is the Daytona 500.
There you go.
And what interest there is outside of Mr. NASCAR's friends, the NASCAR fan community, tends to dwindle as the year goes along. They're going to set up a showdown over the season's last 10 races, and I think by this time next year we'll all think this is a good idea, even Mr. NASCAR, who, as you know, is not a NASCAR purist.
I understand that. Finally, Charlie, the buyer beware warning goes out this week to hikers after it was learned that Trail magazine recently furnished its readers with a potentially disastrous route plan. You want to tell me about this?
Well, if you follow the magazine's directions, and anyone who, by the way, has gotten directions off the Internet and wound up in Vermont when they meant to go to Idaho will understand this. Anyone who followed the directions in Trail magazine regarding the route plan to go up, Ben Nevis, by the way, who does not play fullback for Arsenal but is, in fact, Britain's highest mountain. Anyone who follows their directions about the North Face goes over a cliff into Gardiloo Gully, who, by the way, doesn't play goalie for Manchester United.
Charlie Pierce doesn't play goalie for anybody. He writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. At 2:45 Sunday afternoon, even in Cambridge, Massachusetts, not quite everybody is hunkering down in front of their TV sets to get ready to watch the New England Patriots win the American Football Conference championship. In the auditorium off the lobby in the YWCA in Central Square, a Haitian church service is in progress. And in the lobby itself, the Foursquare players have begun to congregate. They gather around Dana Ostberg and Sean Effel, the co-organizers of the league called Foursquare.org. Together they explain how the league grew out of their recollections of the playground game they enjoyed as kids.
We both have played a lot of Foursquare as kids, and one evening we were...
Skinny dipping.
We'd gone contra dancing, and we're out in White's Pond, and we just sort of happened upon that. I had a bowling bag that I just bought, and we decided that it would be an amazing thing to put your Foursquare ball into your bowling bag, and from there it sort of tumbled into, and then it would be amazing to have a league of Foursquare.
Doubtless, the moment will live in legend among adult devotees of Foursquare, about 40 of whom show up every other Sunday afternoon at this Cambridge Y to bat a ball around in this game you probably last played when you were about 12, at which point you probably played it outdoors, probably on an elementary or middle school playground, so the Sunday indoor league is a deviation Dana Ostberg often finds it necessary to explain.
This is confusing, exactly. Even my dad the other day said, I hope it's a sunny day for Sunday. And I was like, but Dad, we really play inside.
Down two flights of stairs in the Y's very small gym, preparations are underway for today's games. Several of the players are on their hands and knees, marking the squares with masking tape.
Yep, that's the three square. Beautiful. Awesome. All right.
The court consists of a 16 by 16 foot square divided by two perpendicular lines into four identical boxes, labeled 1 through 4. When play begins, each box will contain a player. The player in square number 4 serves a big, bouncy rubber playground ball, preferably red, to one of the other three players who has to tap it to another player's square. The tapping goes on until somebody knocks the ball out of the court or can't reach the ball after it has bounced in his or her square. It's that simple, or it's almost that simple, as I learn when I eavesdrop as a new player, Jack, asks Dana for some guidance.
I need to, like, get briefed on what the rules are so that I don't, like, make any Foursquare faux pas.
The good thing is that people will tell you very quickly.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not in a negative way, but they'll say, you can be like, yo, wait, what does blackjack mean again? And then they'll give it to you.
Yeah, this is a pretty laid-back crowd.
It is, Dana agrees, a pretty laid-back crowd. But she has no more leisure to chat. It's almost time to play.
We are just about ready to begin our game today. I thank you all for making a wise choice of being here and not watching the Patriots. And being an athlete and not a couch potato, a spectator.
There's just room in the gym for two Foursquare courts, so only eight players, four on each court, are actually batting the ball around at any given time. The others form a ragged line between the two courts. The person at the head of the line enters a game when somebody gets knocked out. The player who's been knocked out goes to the back of the line. While a player named Josh is waiting his turn to re-enter one of the squares, he explains to me why each player in square number 4 is saying things like blackjack or double taps.
Blackjack is where if somebody hits it in the air and you can catch it before it bounces, the person who hit it is out.
Oh, so you have that option of catching it rather than playing it?
Yeah, as long as the Foursquare calls it, then you can play the rule.
I got it.
The rules the Foursquare can call in our league are blackjack and poaching, which is where you can hit a ball that's hit into somebody else's square. You can call double taps, which is where you can hit it twice. You can call body language, which is where you can hit it with parts of your body other than your hands. And underhand only, which is what it sounds
only.
Yeah.
Blissfully simple.
Right, and you can call combinations if you want.
Thereby confusing almost everybody.
Right.
Actually, nobody seems confused, even when one of the real Foursquare hotshots on hand, Susie, calls a combination of double taps and body language that has her hipping, kneeing, or heading the ball to herself, then kicking it into an adjacent square. After a long run in the Foursquare, where, like all those who inhabit the fabled box, she must wear a silly tiara-like hat, even Susie gets knocked back into the line. There I have an opportunity to ask her how she'd like it if Foursquare for adults made the big time.
That would be fabulous. I think the best part about it is that if you're not being silly about it, you're probably not going to do well. If you're too sort of competitive, you'll probably screw up. So what makes it that much more exciting if it becomes international is everyone will be really goofy. Like, you have to call body language. You see people professionally, like, chesting and heading the ball, you know, and, like, backwards kicking. That would be fantastic.
In case Foursquare ever does make the Olympics, don't forget that you heard it here first. But Susie's claim that goofiness must necessarily rule seems a little suspect to me as I watch a 6'4" player named Dan tap a ball that drops out of the court and then ask for the ball back so he can serve again. Is he hoping nobody noticed where that one landed?
Of course. I mean, first off, if you think you can get away with it, try and get around it. I, like, try and psych my opponents out, and that was it right there.
You tried.
I tried. That time I failed. It doesn't always happen. Usually it works.
Even Dan can't take his unsuccessful psych attempts too seriously, in part because, in case you hadn't noticed, these Foursquare games are always accompanied by music. I asked Debbie, another one of the players who was actually dancing in line while she waited to enter the game, which hits she most enjoyed playing to.
I think, you know, mid-80s genre, anything sort of peppy, danceable, because usually there's like 20 people in line, and so I, of course, am very comfortable in the line and I, we're one, because you get in and then you get out.
Debbie has no illusions about why she is so often out, as in dancing, while waiting to return to one of the squares.
I am not your typical athlete. I am probably older by 10 years than everybody here, fatter than everybody here, and yet I can still play with the best of them. I get out more often. My scores aren't as great, but it's all good.
It's all good would seem to be a fitting motto for this disparate group of Foursquare players who, they hope, may be starting something big. Sean Affell told me that two of the league's players will be moving soon, and they've each pledged to try to begin Foursquare leagues in their new home cities. Meanwhile, this group that meets once every 2 weeks at the Cambridge YWCA will next play, how could it be otherwise, on Super Bowl Sunday. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Anna Benstead and from Aaron Reed, a.k.a. The Bish. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out photos of the Olympic Village in Athens and some of Foursquare in action, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from the New England Patriots head coach, Bill Belichick.
I think the advantage in the Super Bowl will favor the team that plays well. And I mean that in all sincerity.
That's why I never liked talking about football strategy. Too complicated, especially the syntax. And too sincere. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.